today as a subcommittee. The first order of business is a public hearing on House Bill 3129. And I will open the public hearing on House Bill 3129. And I believe Representative Lem, you are going to lead off testimony.
Thank you.
Can I read the one real quick? House Bill 3129 requires a student who receives diploma from school district to complete 3 years of mathematics and 4 years of English prior to high school graduation.
Thank you very much, Chair Dallin and members of the committee. The hearing, House Bill 3129. For the record, my name is John Lin, state representative from Gresham, District 50. Today I'm here to testify on House Bill 3129. According to the state law, Oregon high school students are only required to take 2 years of math and 3 years of English. This is one of the lowest standards in the country. House Bill 3129 will increase the math and English requirement to 3 years of math and 4 years of English so that we can come to par with most other states. Leaders of 13 states, including our own Kulongoski, attended the National Governors Association Conference concerning standards of U.S. high school performance. Governor Kulongoski promised Oregon will raise the bar for high school students. The article written in Oregonian, February 28, 2005. Based on my office initial research, 44 states have higher standards than Oregon. The majority of the states, 28 on record, require 4 years of English and 3 years of math. Only 6 states have 3 years of English and 2 years of math: Illinois, Utah, Missouri, California, Washington, and Oregon. 3 and 2 is the lowest standard in the nation. Arkansas, New Mexico, Texas require 4 years of English and additional studies in speech. They have been concerned that by increasing math and English requirement, we will be contributing to a higher dropout rate as students struggle through a tougher curriculum. States that require 4 years of English and 3 years of math often have a better success in high school student completion and the lower dropout rate. That has been proven. 16 states with the higher requirement outperformed Oregon in high school completion, and 20 states outperformed Oregon in dropout rate. Therefore, there is no connection between increased mandate and higher dropout rate. As far as spending per pupil is concerned, 17 states have a higher math and English requirement, yet spend less per pupil than Oregon State. Many school districts already require high standards, including Portland Public School. Most of the metro area schools require 4 years of English. There has been concern about the cost of this mandate. Can you afford to implement this mandate? I submit to you, can you afford to be behind other states? The Trade and Economic Committee met in Eugene last Friday with business and civic leaders. The most discussed variable in decurring business is an educated workforce. By passing House Bill 3129, we will be able to compete with the state who have a higher math and English requirement. We will have an educated workforce. House Bill 3129 has 33 co-sponsors in the House, 11 co-sponsors in the Senate, including the chairs of both House and Senate Education. There are several amendments we are considering to this current bill. First, change the starting date to July 1, 2007. Two, consider opt-out clause for the extenuating circumstances. And three, implement English requirement in 2007 and math requirement in 2008. I just had a talk about 10 minutes ago with the representative of Oregon OEA, and they are supportive of this bill, the concept. And then, but when we require of this additional course on math and English, they are also concerned of this mandate more fundings. So with that, I'd like to conclude my remarks on this, my presentation, House Bill 3129.
I might announce that we do have a full committee meeting, a full committee here. We are no longer in subcommittee. Are there any questions for Representative Lim? Yes, Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lim, it has been said that when we toughen up graduation requirements, we have more kids dropping out of school. Do you agree with that, and is there any statistics to support that statement?
As I already stated, that the if you see the dropout rate, you have the copy of this, and it has proven that the higher requirement math and English has not caused any dropout rate. As a matter of fact, those states has a lower dropout rate, even though requiring the math and English.
Thank you.
Are there any other? Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nellum. Representative Lim, you mentioned that this might require additional funding to achieve the success that we are seeking. What would you support to get us there? I mean, how do we get to the additional funding number?
Chair Dallum, Representative March, that's a real good question. That's a very crucial question. And at this time, the co-chairs of both chambers, they are working on the budget numbers. And we know that the Democratic leadership also came up the number. And the House also Republican leadership came up the number. This is a time to negotiate. We all know we are going to maximize the funding for education without sacrificing of the senior citizens and disabled population. We want to make sure they are also well taken care of as we strive to maximize the best funding for the education.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Representative Lim? Representative Lim, you talked about extenuating circumstances and providing an opt-out provision. What sort of circumstances do you see that would make a school eligible for opting out?
As Chair Dallum and the members of the committee, I believe every person is talented in their own way. Some of them more talent doing by hands, some of them in math, and some students we know struggling in math, no question about it. Even though they are good at English, they are good at carpentry and engineering, many others, but some students always struggling in studying math. And so in such circumstances, there should be a way that the student should opt out. One way we thought about it, maybe we can give the district set up their own policy of how to opt out. Or another way that the math teacher or English teacher and a superintendent and several parents, maybe together, they can find out a way to the opt-out. There should be several ways to do that. We are considering whether we should mandate it, who should be involved in it, or should we give the power to school district to have their own policy how to opt-out.
Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you. Mostly a comment on that one, Chair Dolan.
Certainly.
To add to your discussion about that, one of the issues is there. Some of the states that surround us have the less requirement, and a student's parents may choose to move in the district with one semester left, and they were under a requirement that had 3 years of English and 2 years of math, and all of a sudden they have one semester to catch up if they're going to get a diploma. Through no change, it wasn't their fault that the parents chose to move in that last semester. And I think having some options that allow schools to look at that and say, you need to have an opportunity, is one of the others that I think you need to look at.
Thank you very much. And the requirement is good, but that I want to make sure some concerns expressed that the strict mandate is not the only the best way. Some way to opt out is the moderate way to correct the decisions.
Are there any other questions for Representative Lim? If not, thank you very much, Representative Lim, for your presentation. And we'll hear from Deborah L. Andrews.
You and Ms. Bay? No?
Chair Dallum, fellow members of the committee, my name is Deb Andrews. My address is 2806 Northeast Alameda in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today in opposition of House Bill 3129. I have shared written testimony. I hope each of you has a copy of that. I'm all for raising the bar. I've been to Salem before about higher expectations, raising the bar, giving children options to accelerate. I see this bill as really in the way of allowing students options, especially for acceleration. We're talking about the need to better prepare students, all important, our workforce, our society, our state. I heard a principal in Portland address City Club and say that new teachers do not know how to teach children how to read. But yet, I saw the director of TSPC come speak before you and say that everything was fine. A principal that took over a reconstituted school found that the kindergartners knew how to read for the most part. She went to central office for help and they said, no, we're not going to do continuous progress with them because that's not how our reading program works. All this has to do with better preparing students. They need options. I have very briefly included an article from the Oregonian that shows a graph on how performance of students decline as they move through the grades. If they are not mentally engaged, if they're not being challenged by the time they get to the 10th grade, why would we want to force them to have more of the same without looking at what's going on in that math class? What's going on in that English class? How does it help them become better prepared? I have a couple of examples of school districts where it shows how costly it is to not engage students, to not challenge them. School district number one, the spending was high per student in 92, $7,500. The class size was small. It was a wealthy district. You can see there were concerns there. On page 5, the student's handwriting shows extreme stress. 6, the outlook for this student in the future is not good. This was very expensive. Lots of staff was involved, lots of counseling. The teacher comments on page 8 kind of sum it up. He was successful at nothing. Comments on page 9 from the teacher also successful at nothing. He wasn't learning. Moved to a school district that spent almost half as much per year. The class sizes were higher, but they grouped by ability. This was in 92. There were some differences in that district. As a result, the child did very well. The child was learning, got along with his classmates, made great gains, so that by age 15, he was presenting the results of his research for NASA to the Nebraska Academy of Sciences. Mentally engaged, cost less money, was not required to stay at the high school and take a certain number of courses. There are a lot of children that need those options. This, I believe, House Bill 3129 does not help better prepare our students. I think it does require more staff, more funding, and perhaps more medication for our students. Thank you.
Go ahead. We may have a question or two.
Oh, sorry.
Before I give the Gavel back to the chairman. Are there any questions?
I have one question.
Representative Lim.
Yes, thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Do you believe that requiring less will increase students' academy and productivity in the future?
I believe truly raising the bar is very important. I think challenging the student, requiring more of them in the way of learning all along the way, is what's going to make the difference. I think by requiring simply the course name and the structure that we have will not get us where we need to go.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
Additional questions? Representative Roland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine is along that same line, actually. So you're not opposed to the idea of the kinds of requirements, i.e. math, English, and science, as much as it is the fact that we aren't addressing what you believe is the root problem, which is...
What is being offered? Okay. What is that class made up of? When AP classes are offered, how many children take the AP test, and how many of those students pass the test? That's key to what's really going on. What is there rigor? Is there challenge?
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Andrews, how do you propose we do that? By keeping standards low? Do you think we can raise the bar on student performance?
I think the standards should focus on the instructor.
So
I think if you had something like other states do, a value-added assessment, and you could measure the growth of the student from year to year, you hopefully would not end up with things like this graph that shows students are less engaged year to year. With value-added assessment, you look at the growth of the student. If the student isn't making any growth in a year in a teacher's class or in this AP calculus class or whatever it is, that's your key. There's something wrong with the course or the teacher. It is not working. It is not getting us where we need to go.
Follow up. So how do you propose, because of the number of school districts we have in Oregon, the number of schools within those school districts, and then the number of administrators and educators in each school, how do you propose that we really address the problem in a collective way that's going to make a difference?
I think the Department of Education already has that information. I don't think it's being gathered or looked at, but I believe that information is available.
Okay, so one more thought. I've had three. I'm sorry.
One more thing.
Yes, Ms. Andrews, please.
And other states have instituted that, so we would not be reinventing the wheel.
I'm sorry. Could you restate what you just said? Instituted
value-added assessment.
Value-added assessment. Really, what I wanted to do was make a comment, but I was hoping that you could respond to it, if you would indulge me, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
Having three children that have gone through the public school system and one that is currently a senior in high school, I found that teachers really varied not only from school to school, but from class to class. And perhaps in second grade there were four teachers, in third grade there were four teachers, and three out of those four teachers were probably excellent teachers, and maybe one of the teachers really didn't have an understanding of how to work with special needs students. My kids were all, they were considered gifted. I mean, they met the testing requirements for gifted education. So it seems like it's going to be a really difficult task to look at each teacher's performance, not only within the grade level, but within the school and within the district. So I'm curious. I really want to know how other states have been able to approach this and solve the problem.
I'm not an expert in value-added assessment. I know that it is key to determining whether or not there are good things going on in that classroom, and I think there needs to be accountability for the teachers and the teacher preparation. The teacher colleges right now are not accountable. If they turn out new teachers that do not know how to teach children how to read, That's a crime. That shouldn't be happening. There should be accountability there. Could they be put under value added as well? If they're turning out teachers that get into the classroom that aren't able to teach children how to read, there should be accountability for that. And as long as there's not, the problem gets passed along to the student that has to take 4 years of math. What math?
Thank you.
No further questions? Thank you, Ms. Anders.
Thank you.
Margaret DeLacy.
Good afternoon. Are we live here? Okay. For the record, my name is Margaret DeLacy. Do you want my full address?
No, that's fine.
I live in Portland. I am a board member of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted, OTAG. I'm not representing them today because I haven't had a chance to discuss this bill with them. It came up pretty quickly, and I've been out of town. So I'm here representing myself today. I want to also express reservations about this bill. I can't tell you how strongly I share your goal in this bill to raise the bar for all students. I absolutely agree that that's what we must do. However, I'm very concerned that this bill will have some unintended consequences. The bill requires 4 years of English and 3 years of mathematics while in high school. We have a rather large number of students who begin their math curriculum in middle school for high school credit. And those students might well find themselves required to take a year of math, which is not offered in the high school. My own son would be an example. He completed Calculus 1 as a sophomore. And in most schools in the state, including his own, he would not have been able to acquire that third year of math while in high school. He had a choice. He actually chose to go to Portland State to do another year of math. But in my opinion, it's unreasonable for the state to demand any student to complete math beyond first year calculus. And we might be in the position of putting him in that position. The comment that we heard most often when my son was interested in moving ahead in math was, well, what are you going to do at the other end? He's going to run out of math. And I always thought that was kind of a strange thing to say because I don't believe there's a limitation on the amount of math in the world. You know, there's always more math to learn. But it would be the case that if he was required to have 3 years of high school math, he could run out of math at the high school level before he ran out of the 3 years. We have quite a substantial number of students in that position in the state, and there's no provision in this bill to address their needs. I believe many of those students would be better off going to college early and not having to remain in high school for a fourth year merely to take an English class, for example, when they've already exceeded the standards in English in 10th grade, which means they're at a college level already. Most of these students complete all their requirements at the end of their junior year, and many of them simply want to go on to college. And I don't think it's really fair to deny them a diploma when they've done everything we've asked them to do and performed very well. I brought to show you an example of a sort of a real quick and dirty example of gains-based analysis. In the Portland Public School District keeps track of student gains. And that is this table that I've handed around. It comes straight from the Portland Public School website. Let me tell you why it's important to look at student gains and not just at seat time or aggregate test scores. Taking an aggregate test score is like measuring the height of the students in a classroom. It tells you how much every child has grown since they were born. It does not tell you how much they've grown while they're in that classroom. In order to understand whether a student is learning while the student is in a classroom, you have to look at the difference between their score at one year, at the end of 1 year, and their score at the end of the next year. And that's what this website does, except it aggregates the grades. So you have an elementary, middle school, and high school table here. And if you look at it, you'll see that the I'm only going to address the high school today because that's what this bill addresses. You'll see that students who exceed benchmarks make a very, very small gain in reading, I think about a point or two between 10th grade and 8th grade, from the end of their 8th grade year to the 10th grade year. And they make no gains at all in math. Now, there's some, I could go on forever about issues with this data. This is not ideal data. But on the other hand, we don't care enough about these students to be doing a better job of tracking their data. And in fact, the state doesn't provide this data, which is why I've used Portland Public Schools. Portland is roughly 10% of the students in the state. But I can't see any point in requiring years of seat time from students who demonstrably are not learning anything in those seats. We are asking the taxpayer to pay approximately $7,500 per student per year for students who are not learning in school. And now we're talking about a bill that will require them to stay longer to fulfill requirements that may not, in fact, be providing them with any additional learning. So I'm hoping that you will come up with procedures to make sure that the students don't just have a seat time requirement, but actually have a learning requirement. And I think I'll end there. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Lacy, Representative Roblin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if, in fact, I understand some of your other objections, but one of the ones that I clearly have seen over and over again is the idea that there isn't enough math offered at the high school to meet it, nor do some schools grant credit for work done at the middle school level, even if it's high school level work. Representative Lim in his testimony indicated that there was a possibility of some amendments that might make some of those exceptions. So if that one was taken care of, are you still concerned? I mean, if we took care of some of those concerns in an amendment?
Representative Flores, Representative Roblin, there's the devil is always in the details. I believe that it would be possible to come up with a bill that would create criteria for how much math a student needs to know when they graduate, and that would give credit for high school classes taken before entering ninth grade. But the bill as it's written now does neither of those. And so at this point, I would ask you not to approve the bill. If there are amendments, if somebody wants to work on amendments, I'd be happy to discuss those and see if we can come up with something that would work.
Representative Dahlem.
With the advanced students, I want to explore this provision to opt out. As Representative Lim told us, there is an opt-out provision if they've met, or that at the local level, if a student has demonstrated proficiency, that may be an opt-out. And we had a whole host of others. We also have a Senate Bill 300 that would allow them to attend community college, I think. It seems like those, when we drive this to the local level, we allow the local school district to determine when students have met standard, but that still concerns you?
Chair Flores, Representative Dallum, my concern is that this bill, the language of this bill merely addresses seat time. It does not talk about proficiency. And in addition, I was hoping that Senate Bill 300 would enable all of our high school students who exceed standards to have the opportunity to take college-level work. I have been sitting on the work group for Senate Bill 300, and I can tell you right now that it's not going to do that as currently proposed. It places quite strict limitations on the number of students who will be able to participate. I believe that every student who is ready for college work should be able to do college work. I think that every student is entitled to free and appropriate education. And if we could come up with a bill that would provide free and appropriate education to every one of our high school students, I would be the first person in line to support it. I've been trying to get proposals like that passed for many, many years. But this bill simply says 4 years of English between grades 9 and 12 and 3 years of math. It does not address any of those proficiency issues or college-level issues. And, right, I don't believe that what we're looking at with Senate Bill 300 will make that available to every student who needs it.
Representative Lynn.
Okay. Thank you very much for the point you are bringing in. This point is well taken, and we are acutely aware of the problems you are saying, and because of the reason we are going to amend it. The bill, as it is written, it is not, so I'm going to work with you and my staff, make sure there is an opt-out clause for the students. Less achievement or overachievement, there should be an opt-out clause in it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. Are there any other questions?
It appears not. Thank
you. May I add one thing?
Surely.
Just to give you some idea of how many students you're speaking of. Approximately 15% of the students in Oregon exceed benchmarks in the 10th grade in reading and math. The number who exceed in writing is quite small. So you're talking about a very large number of students who are already performing at a college level. This is not an issue for one or two students. It's tens of thousands of students, I believe, over the time that they're in school. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Burke?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, I'm Pat Burke, Chief Policy Officer of the Department of Education. I'm here to speak about House Bill 3129, which raises the graduation requirement for high school graduation by adding 1 year of English and 1 year of mathematics. I want to really express our appreciation to Representative Lim for raising this issue and for the bill that has been introduced, particularly as I found out this afternoon some of the amendments that are being proposed, which I think add very much to the bill. I believe Representative Lim stated fairly accurately what some of the issues are in this area. I don't need to repeat that information. There have been a variety of studies that, as the representative pointed out, express Oregon's position nationally. Not only is it low in terms of the number of years of mathematics, but we also offer credit for course content that many would consider to be below high school level, that is pre-algebra or other courses that typically you would consider represent a high school curriculum, which typically starts at the algebra level. So we in general, are very supportive of the idea and think this is an issue that really does need to be looked at. And we want to work with you on that. As I've testified in earlier testimony before this committee, the Oregon Department of Education is generally supportive of adding more rigor to our high school programs. And to this end, we do not necessarily oppose House Bill 3162. However, as I said last week, our preference is to look at this issue within the context of school reform comprehensively, because these issues are all interconnected. So let me talk a little bit about that. The bill does not call for a fiscal analysis or implementation strategy. And actually hearing the proposed amendments to the phase-in actually gives me a little bit cause to breathe a little bit easier about the length of time. But here's what I think is the issue there. We would need to know what our current operating capacity is. Now, we know that there is the two-unit minimum in mathematics, but we also know that many of our students take more than 2 years. So the system has a current capacity that it's already delivering, and we would need to identify what that is, and then the gap between what that current capacity is and what it would take in addition to require that level of instruction for every student. We currently have about 47,000 high school students in the state. Now, part of the problem with that is that the 2 years of mathematics required in Oregon actually goes back to the early 1950s. It was first proposed in 1950 to go from 1 year unit of math to two. Now, part of the issue there was that Oregon, to today, although gradually have changed over the years, had both junior high schools and senior high schools. And the junior high school curriculum typically included what we would normally recognize as ninth grade. And the senior high school was typically a three-year program. So 3 years of English, 2 years of math seemed like a reasonable thing at the time. Most of our high schools now, however, are four-year, ninth grade through 12th grade, and the 3 years of English, 2 years of math appears to be somewhat out of whack, especially as Representative Lim pointed out, in comparison to the rest of the country. So we would want to know what that gap in capacity is, and then want to know how many teachers it would take, how many sections would it be required to fill the gap, and how many teachers would it take to provide those levels of sections, and then ultimately to calculate a cost to add those teachers. So that would take some work and needs to be done. Again, going back to the amendments that Representative Lim proposed, staggering the implementation of English and the implementation of math is also a very good idea and one that we would support because we know, frankly, that finding more licensed math teachers is going to be a problem. We have more capacity in English. We know from our current experience that we're running a shortage of math and science teachers. My second point is I don't know much about the opt-out provision and would want to know more about how that would work. And that again is something that I think we could work on in the interim. My third point has to do with a real fundamental policy question that I would ask the committee to think about. Ultimately, this would have to go to a rule change by adding something into statute, adding the year of English and the year of math. The current rule is a universe of 22 units of credit, and within that 22, some are required and some are electives. If we stay within the universe of 22 units, I have a concern that adding two more required courses would put a downward pressure on electives as long as we stayed within 22. Schools and districts would be faced with saying, okay, I've got to provide more English and more math, but I only have staff to do 22 units of credit, so I'm going to cut some of my electives and move that staff into required courses. Or perhaps apropos to the prior two speakers, if I've got AP classes with small numbers in them, say a class of 15 to 20, and I've got a larger class size in my general math program, I might feel pressure to cut the elective and move the staff into the required program. Our preference, Madam Chair, and what I would hope the committee is thinking of, is adding to the requirements, moving from 22 to 24. In that case, we would actually be looking at a need for additional teachers to expand our course offerings. I believe that's the right way to go. I think that helps preserve our elective program, but obviously that has a cost associated with it, and we would want to calculate that. I appreciate the testimony from Representative Lim about ramping up. This is something that will require some planning. Adding the additional requirement would also mean adding textbook purchases, adding supplies and materials, adding equipment. Particularly in the math program, it's absolutely essential that every student have access to a graphing calculator. We're more and more moving information onto the web for both English writing and mathematics instruction. What is the level of resource necessary to support that increase in instruction? My next point has to do with aligning the system, and that too would require some work, and you've already heard some testimony about that today. The system needs to be aligned in two ways if we do this. First, you want to make sure that we are appropriately aligned to the middle school curriculum. I would not recommend doing this in isolation. We have to look at what is the level of instruction at the middle school level and how does that feed into a high school program. just speaking personally, not necessarily for the agency, I believe our goal should be, at a minimum, pre-algebra by the eighth grade. Frankly, I would prefer to see algebra by the eighth grade, but at a minimum, making sure that that middle school program aligns in a very rigorous way to what we are expecting at the high school level. And then we offer high school content for high school credit. Likewise, you would want to look at how does the other end align. We know, for example, that many of our students are currently taking math in high school for college credit. You have heard Superintendent Castillo, the governor, and many others talk about the need to do more of that, and that is something we certainly support. Being able to align content to higher standards gives us a way to connect better to post-secondary success. And then finally, I would simply suggest, Madam Chair, for your consideration, we introduced amendments to House Bill 3162 last week. I would refer the committee to those amendments in that they provide a way to have these conversations. It basically recommends that the joint boards study these issues in their comprehensiveness over the interim and develop implementation strategy. You also have before you Committee Bill 3180, which does something very similar to you. But in general, we support this idea, want to work with the committee and with Representative Lim in getting us there, and I appreciate the committee's time this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Dr. Burke? Representative Dahlem.
Yes, Dr. Burke, if we were to acquaint or associate standards with level of expected proficiency. Now, where are we in the standards? Do we expect algebra? Do we expect geometry? Do we expect introduction to the calculus? Just where are we in the math standards?
Excellent question, Madam Chair. Representative Dahlem, thank you for the question. You're right on target. The current assessment, which is currently conducted at 10th grade, for the first time, students have actually until high school graduation to keep working toward the standards. The assessment includes basically four areas of content: algebra, geometry, statistics and probability, and math problem solving. And if you look at the type of assessments that are contained, or the questions that are in the assessment, they roughly cover what would be the equivalent of Algebra 1 and 2 and geometry. Kind of looked at the standard course syllabi that of those courses. That's what it would contain. So there's an opportunity here, I didn't mention this in my earlier testimony, to align the assessment to the course content. So, and what I mean by looking at this comprehensively, if we were to require 3 years of mathematics, to me it makes some sense to consider moving the 10th grade assessment to the 11th grade year so that the assessment follows the level of instruction that we're providing all of our students. So, but right now, the current standards address, at least on the assessment, up through math problem solving and the equivalent of Algebra 2.
Thank you very much.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Burke, you mentioned the shortage in math and science teachers. Do you know how, sort of, in, is it more pronounced in rural areas, urban areas? What's the issue there?
Madam Chair, Representative March, it is more pronounced in the rural areas. We have had a more difficult time in the rural areas meeting the requirements of the No Child Left Behind Act for highly qualified teachers. Just as a reminder to the committee, that requires that the teacher have at least a bachelor's degree in the content area, be fully licensed by the state, and their assignment be within their area of endorsement. Currently, our rural and smaller schools have a much more difficult time, and as a result, they are reporting more teachers not meeting those requirements. In some ways, Representative March, this the proposal could help that, because schools would be required to provide more mathematics, which may mean that you would have more full-time positions. But again, there's a cost implication there, and we would want to work that out.
Thank you.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Burke, thank you very much for your testimony. Is it true that Portland School District already, they do have 3 years of math and 4 years of English in Portland School District?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, when I left the district, which was 2.5 years ago, it was 4 years of English, and the minimum was still 2 years of mathematics. It is my understanding that Superintendent Phillips intends to increase both the math and the science requirement to 3. But as far as I know, Representative Lim, their board has not yet approved that part of it. But the 4-year English requirement is a requirement in Portland.
Okay, and the follow-up?
Follow-up.
So when state requiring in school district, that means require more money, more funding. That is the very crucial issue. Since Portland area already is doing it, most of it, and do you think when we require this math and English one more year each, it will require more money, since already most of them already are doing it?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, in the Portland area, I really could not answer that without studying it carefully. This is what I mean by looking at existing delivered capacity versus needed capacity. But you're right on target with what my concern is. I think there is considerable capacity in the system now, particularly in some of our larger districts. We do have a lot of students who take not only 3 years of math, they take 4 years of math. They take 4 years of science. My son took 4 years of math, 4 years of science. So you would want to know the difference between what you can currently deliver and what would be required to do that for everyone. And I do think there's more capacity in some of the larger districts to do that than there is in some of the smaller and more rural areas.
Okay. Thank you very much. My comment, Madam Chair. Because of that, the funding and the implementation issue, the way I like to propose your amendment is a requirement by 2007, English. And then because of the shortage of licensed teacher on math and science, my amendment is going to show 2008. And so just 1 year behind. So at least it is not, no impact on this current biennium at this time.
Thank you, Representative Lim. I hope you'll keep us all posted as you move forward with those amendments.
Thank you.
We are all supportive.
Madam Chair, may I ask just a word of clarification? Representative Lim, you just said something that made me a little nervous.
Okay.
You said math and science by 08.
No.
Okay.
Right. Well, he was using your
example. I didn't mean it.
As much as I want to do science, frankly, yeah. Representative Lim, and I think you are aware of this, I really think science needs to be added in the long run, but science has a whole different set of capital costs with laboratory spaces, and that really will take a lot of study to look at.
So. Thank you for clarification.
And Dr. Burke, when you were talking about the potential rule changes regarding the 22 units that are currently required some elective, what is that administrative rule reference?
The reference is Division 22. It's what are called the compliance regulations or the Division 22 regulations in Oregon Administrative Rule. And within the rule, Madam Chair, are the minimum number of credits required for a high school diploma. And were this bill to pass, that rule would need to be amended by the State Board.
With the utmost haste, I'm sure. Timeliness.
They are anxious to talk about it. This is certainly on the agenda for the State Board.
Thank you very much. If there's no further questions, thank you. Is there anyone else that would wish to give testimony on House Bill 3129? How about of our guest interns, our guest pages out there? How do you feel about that? Nods increasing from already required. You want to step up?
Welcome, Jacob. Jacob is
What was
your name?
My name's Paige Greenlee, and this is
James Stark. We're both from the youth advisory team for Susan Castillo.
Thank you. And what school do you go to?
I go to South Eugene High School.
South Eugene?
I go to Madras High School.
Okay. And in South Eugene, it's already required 3 math, 4
exactly.
English.
It's we have 4 English and 2 in math.
Okay.
But in our school, there's courses available for 4 years. I took 5 years of science, 4 years of math, and 4 years of English. And it's all available. It's whether they take it or not. And truly, I think if you increased it, I don't think it would be as much of a funding problem as we all think, because they're available. I just don't think they're being applied. And truly, 22 credits, you can almost fail. In my mind, you can almost fail a complete year and still be on track for graduation.
That would gratify some folks.
So, I mean, if we increase up to 24 credits, I don't see a problem with that at all, because it's a low standard. So,
At my school, it's only possible to get 7 credits a year, so the credit increase would have more bearing at my school. But we also have in place several programs through the University of Oregon and Lane Community College to get high school credit through classes at the colleges. So increasing requirements wouldn't harm the accelerated students because of that, those programs. And that goes back to Senate Bill 300, because that would institute more of those programs throughout the state.
Would you mind answering a couple questions? I know Representative Dolan's just burning to ask.
Jacob, I'll go to you. As a senior at Madras High School, you can see the quality of students in House District 59. How many
that was
kids,
just perfect.
How many students in your class, Jacob, have taken additional math and science?
In my class, I would have to say it's around about 40 to 50 kids. It depends. It changes for all advanced classes. If you take the students who took all advanced classes for English, science, and math, it'd probably be down to 12. But all together who take either English or just math, I think it would be around 40 students who actually take them.
Would it be, if I ask you, do students seek the lowest level of requirement to get out of Madras High School, or do they?
Yes, they do.
Oh, that answers both parts of the question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being willing to come forward.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3129. We will move to opening a public hearing on House Bill 3075. Mr. Keller?
Ma'am. House Bill 3075 directs that child who is placed by public or private agency in substitute care program is considered resident for school purposes in school district in which child resided prior to placement, allows child to continue to attend school child attended prior to placement, directs the court to give preference in placements to persons who can maintain the child in the same school or educational placement as prior to placement, changes time period for transfer of education records of child who is in substitute care program when child transfers from one school or educational placement to another, directs the placement agency is responsible for providing transportation for the child, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2005, does not have a subsequent referral.
Thank you. Senator Kate Brown. Thank you for taking time from your busy schedule to be here today.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 21, East Portland, and the City of Milwaukee. I very much appreciate you giving House Bill 3075 a hearing. I think it's a really pretty straightforward bill that could have a huge impact on a number of children's lives. Classroom teachers all over Oregon can attest to the fact that high mobility rate is a student, in a student population leads to decreased classroom performance. By amending Oregon school district residency requirements to permit a child in foster care to remain in the school they attended prior to placement in the system, we will be giving children a piece of stability and an increased chance for academic success. I used to practice law in juvenile court. I did dependency work. I spent a number of years in Multnomah County doing it. It was really gratifying but very difficult work. I will not forget the young client I represented. He was probably 8 at the time. His records revealed that before he was 2, he was in over 15 foster care homes. And, of course, by the time I represented him, he, of course, had attachment disorder amongst other issues. I just think if we can give children in foster care one piece of stability in their lives by allowing them to remain in their schools, it will make a huge difference. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I thank you very much for hearing this bill.
Thank you. Other questions for Senator Brown? Representative Dahl?
Yes, Senator. With the bill, and it makes sense to me that we make a continuous effort or an effort at a continuous education, but how would we handle then transportation? As I understand it, our student could go through a series of foster homes, and they could be adjacent to, far from, the homeschool. How would you get them there and back, and who's responsible for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, my understanding is that the school district would not be required to provide the transportation, but that the agency responsible for the welfare of the child would be required to provide the transportation. I just have to tell you, Madam Chair and Representative Dahlem, that I find it completely unacceptable the number of moves that these children make while they're in foster care. And if by encouraging agency to keep them in the same school district, we can also encourage some stability in the home itself, I think this bill would have a huge impact. So, I just think this is really important.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you. This is a comment and kind of a question to find out if you have seen the same similar situations at the high school level. Oftentimes, these foster students make relationships with individual teachers, which are probably as strong as the relationships they make in their foster homes. And changing that creates a major handicap for that child, regardless of the education part, but also for the support structure that they've developed for themselves many times. Have you seen the same thing?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I did not, because most of the kids that I represented were substantially younger. But I totally agree that having one stable adult in these kids' lives, particularly when they're teenagers, can really have a huge impact.
Representative
Dolan? The idea intrigues me of leaving a student where they are. However, with the foster care system and having a passing knowledge of the foster care system, if we're not going to move the student, could we then move the money? It's one of the issues that happens in my district is we have a home set up that will take in all kinds of students with all kinds of abilities and disabilities and that sort of thing. And there our concern is moving money out to the school. We could provide some permanence, but would you consider then moving the money? Could that be an amendment that we would look at? If a foster student is assigned to another district, but we leave him in that school, can we move the money?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I'm certainly willing to have that conversation. I have not served on any of the education committees, and I'm unfamiliar of the difficulties it takes to have money follow students between school districts. So I don't know how difficult the problem that would require a solution for. If that sounds so.
We might have a vehicle to do that.
Okay,
we can
great.
Have a discussion, certainly. So we'll follow up and back around with that.
And, Madam Chair, one of the issues that was raised to me out in the hallway by the education community is that current law requires that the record transfer be within 10 days. The bill that is in front of you asks for a 3-day transfer. Educational community was concerned that the 3-day transfer might be too quick. I'm certainly willing to have conversations about the 3-day timeline, but it certainly needs to be within a relatively short period of time. And 10 days in a small child's life is a very long time. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you hearing this bill.
All on one line, I have Julie McFarlane, Amanda Burback, Brian Baker, and Angela Sherbo. Do you all wish to come forward at the same time? Okay. Have your way.
Chair Flores and members of the committee, I'm Angela Sherbo, a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. This bill is our bill and our child, in a way. With me, I have Brian Baker, who's the senior education attorney in our office, Julie McFarlane, who's the other supervising attorney, and Julie's foster daughter, Amanda. Each of us has something to say. I will try and keep mine the shortest. Our office has been around for over 25 years. We represent thousands of children in foster care. Julie and I both have represented children so long ago that we are now seeing their children coming back through the system, coming back through the detention system, coming back through the foster care system. We know these kids. What Senator Brown talked to you about is something that happens daily in the lives of each of the 18 attorneys in my office. They see children. I just staffed a case with someone who's got a child who's been in 9 foster homes in the last 9 months. I represented 2 young boys, who one of whom was in second and the other in third grade, had been in 7 schools. This is our attempt to look at all of the entities that have some responsibility for these children and to create a partnership and to spread the burden. We do not suggest that there isn't some burden, some additional burden posed by the bill in terms of the way schools and the foster care agencies and the courts will operate. We think it's important that they do this, that this is an important constituency who needs the help of all of the adults involved in their lives. When I say it's a partnership, what I'm talking about is this. We are adding activities for each, the court, the foster care system and the schools, but we're not asking them to do anything that they don't already do. We're simply asking them to do it either faster or harder or for more students. So, for example, the bill asks the court to make determinations about best interests. That's a uniquely court activity, something the juvenile court does all the time. We're asking the court to appoint a surrogate, that's someone to stand in the stead of the parent for a special ed student. The court already does that, has the authority to do that. We move that forward so we don't lose the kind of time once a kid comes into care, getting the educational piece in order. The court is also, in this bill, directed to give placement to certain kinds of homes. Again, a uniquely court function, something they do already, weigh individual circumstances in individual cases and make determinations about what's best for kids for whom the parent is no longer making that decision. We look at the Department of Human Services and the other foster care entities and say, you already have and are very proud of a system of neighborhood foster care. It is DHS's design and desire to place kids close to home. We want to improve on this, and we want to send the message, it's the legislative policy of this state, that kids, all other things being equal, ought to have as much stability as possible at the moment when everything else has shattered for them. DHS also already has a system for reimbursing foster parents for transportation to schools when the district doesn't provide that. So again, we want to build on something that exists. With respect to the schools, schools already have the capacity to do an inter-district transfer. They already educate children who live outside of their bounds. We want them to focus specifically on this group of kids for whom educational stability is more important, as I said before, when the rest of the stability is gone. And with respect to the last point that Senator Brown made, yes, we are asking in this bill for the schools to speed up the transfer of records for this group of kids. We understand it poses a burden, and we are willing and have talked with the education community, with the foster care community, with the juvenile courts for the last year and a half, and we're absolutely willing to continue to do that throughout this session to come up with something that, that all can live with. But we do want to say, sort of, you know, without any pretense, we do want something more for these kids because they lack so much else. Thank you very much.
My name is Brian Baker. I'm a staff attorney with the Juvenile Rights Board. I'd like to reiterate, as Ms. Sherbo testified, that we've worked very closely over the last year and a half with all of our community partners in developing this bill and identifying the special needs of the population of children that we work with. This bill is really about educational stability, at improving academic achievement for the children that we work with, at maintaining, as Senator Brown testified, maintaining positive peer relationships and positive relationships that children have with school teachers and school administrators. Unfortunately, in our practice, I've been a juvenile court practitioner for 10 years. I have seen too many of my clients move 2, 3, 4 times during an academic year. Those placements are often made on a crisis basis. Whether or not the child can be maintained in the school placement really falls to the bottom of the equation. It's more looking to is there a home that we can drop the child off at 5 p.m. that evening, or is the child going to stay at the DHS welfare office for another 6 hours? Those types of things. What our bill does is add to the statutory preference an additional preference to attempt to keep a child in his or her neighborhood, maintain that school placement. It doesn't place that preference above any of the other preferences, such as relatives. It supports DHS in their efforts to have more children placed within their neighborhoods, and that notion of neighborhood foster care. We very strongly support that. There has been, in the last several years, last 4 or 5 years, studies that are now coming out at the national level that are really beginning to track the outcomes of children in foster care. And they're very poor. And we're very concerned that children are leaving the system unprepared to leave independent, productive lives. Very high percentages fail to graduate high school, 46% at a national level. So many, many of our children are ending up literally on the streets as they leave the system, without family support, needing to access public assistance, needing Medicaid. They're very vulnerable to crime, to being victims of crime. So a whole host of very negative outcomes. We strongly believe that graduating high school, that having academic achievement will work a more positive outcome for our children. We very much want to work with all of our community partners to move this bill forward. In the course of writing it, we've had ongoing discussions and continue to have those discussions. So as concerns have come up, we're very willing to address those. I feel it's important to specifically address the records issue. I know that has been a significant concern. Again, this is from our experience that our current statute requires 10 days to request records and 10 days to send them, so ostensibly a 20-day turnaround time. We've written in a 6-day turnaround time. The reason is this is a specific population of children who are very vulnerable to inappropriate school placement, to placement in the school setting where their individual needs are not met. We have a very high rate of children with disabilities. 30 to 50% of children in foster care have special ed needs. If that child is placed in a school and those school records are not there, that individual education plan is not there, the receiving school is very much at a loss as to what type of appropriate placement, what are the services that need to be put in place, the temporary services. And we wrote this section as to emphasize the need to have expedited communication, whether that's a phone call, a requesting a fax, an email. It's extremely necessary. All too often, and very often actually, we see records not reach school within the statutory time frame. There can be times that a child's records haven't arrived after 30 days or 2 months. I've seen that that type of situation. So that was the thought behind the expedited records section. We have today brought with us a child who has experienced foster care, and I want to give her the opportunity to present to the committee. But please, if there are questions.
I think we'll hold our questions till you all have an opportunity to present.
Thank you.
My name is Amanda Burbank. I'm 15 years old, and I've been in foster care for the past 10 years. Over the course of time, I've been in 11 placements and 9 different schools. In the period of 5 years, I was in 8 schools, 8 different schools. And I usually moved between semesters or quarters, so I would miss classes and things like that. And then when I went to the next school, I would be behind and I had to learn all the stuff again, or they would skip it and then I'd have to learn something else. And in seventh grade, that was the first school I actually got to attend a full year since fourth grade. And then in eighth grade, I was moved at the spring mark to Reynolds Learning Academy, where I am now. And like staying in one place has like brought my grades up, and it's just like easier, I guess. And staying in one school has also helped me to become involved with more programs. And right now I'm a member of REACH, which is Recruit, Educate, and Creating Homes. And it's a group of foster teens who are aware of severe shortage of good foster homes for teens. And you guys got a brochure? And yeah, that's it.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Julie McFarlane, and I am a supervising attorney at Juvenile Rights Project, but I'm here today to talk to you as a foster parent. I've been a foster parent for 9 years, and I've had 6 children in my care, and every single one of them has come to me with educational difficulties. All but one had to be moved to a new school district when they were moved to my home, and that caused even worse educational difficulties for them. The one child that I did have, who I still have actually, who was able to remain in her school district, did substantially better because she could remain in that school. She wanted to remain in that school. She had relationships, the school teacher in her special education classroom and the school counselor had been very helpful to her in getting out of the abusive situation that she was in. So it made her feel very secure to have that continuing relationship. She has experienced a good deal more educational success than most of the other children that I have had, and I think that that was a direct result of that continuity.
Thank you. Can either of you tell me why there are, in the instances that you cite, so many placements made over such a short period of time from the foster care agencies and DHS? I mean, why are kids moved around so often?
Chair Flores, members of the committee, well, I think that there are a variety of reasons. Foster homes are not well equipped for serious problems that children have. In many cases, children that I have had were had to be placed in residential treatment and were either coming out of residential treatment or going into residential treatment, and that was one of the reasons that they had to be changed. As Amanda indicated in her part of our letter, she had to leave some foster homes because they were simply quitting being foster parents. She also left a foster home because she was abused there. So there's just a large variety of reasons. I think, however, that that's certainly my opinion, that we don't have a very good or deep pool of foster parents, and that that's a part of the problem.
Questions? Representative Farr.
I have a question that may be a follow-up to Chair Flores' question. Would you say that some foster parents actually enter the system for financial gain?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, I think that, that my foster daughter is saying, oh, yeah, and that certainly is a perception that is out there. I think, you know, my experience with the process of becoming certified was that you were pretty strongly discouraged from that. And what we know is that the amount of money that DHS pays foster parents is about 50% of what it actually costs to have a foster child. So unless you're getting a special rate, which are not given out in all cases, you're not even making your costs. So for the most part, I really believe that foster parents ought to become foster parents because they want to do a service and not for the money. But there's that perception, and the kids certainly have it.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
Well, the reason that I asked that question is I think that some people become foster parents, but they don't really fully realize what they're getting themselves into.
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, I absolutely agree with that. And then I think that leads to people who are foster parents for a couple of years and realize that they can't either handle the seriousness of the child or the financial burden that they may not fully have realized they were taking on by taking the child.
So that could account for the number of placements per child?
I would expect that's at least part of it.
Representative Lim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any way we can screen out those adult or parents whose record is not fit for to have a foster child? How could we find out that you testified that they have been abusive to some instances, and how could we find out they are not?
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, I think that that is a very serious problem and concern for DHS. I think that the certification process does try to screen out people who are going to be abusive. The agency has adopted a policy of requiring caseworkers to have face-to-face contacts with children in the home so that they can be more aware of those situations. And still, we know that it's a situation that's hard to detect and that those cases will occur.
Okay. Thank you. Just a comment. It's very hard for the, did you say your name, Amanda? You moved, the six times, 4 or 5 years? What was that? How many times did you move?
I had 11 placements.
11, that's too much for anyone else, you know, but I'm hoping and I'm praying that you are going to do good in the future. And God bless you, your effort.
Representative
Cronin. I guess this is for the Department of Human Services. When a student is moved in a foster situation and the school is involved, is there a staffing with the school that involves human resource people, the school district, and counselors and others that may be able to resolve the situation? Are you staffed that way? Do you have a meeting where we're all involved in this, sit down at the same table?
Chair Flores, Representative Dallum, I'm not with the Department of Human Services. We are all with the Juvenile Rights Project. They will be coming up, but I can speak to that because I've had many, many years' experience representing kids in foster care. There are certainly occasions when a child is moved. It's a planned move. Everyone knows in advance where the child's going. They know what school they're going to. There's a good caseworker, a good foster parent, an active lawyer. In those cases, it is the design of the system to staff things, to meet together collaboratively, and to plan. Then there are those cases that you hear about where there is no plan. The something happens, the child has to be moved that night, the child ends up wherever there's an empty pillow. And sorry to say it so plainly, but that the system is so short-resourced and so crisis-driven that there are many occasions, the absolute flip side of the planned good situation, where a child simply ends up in another district. We have had a case recently with four siblings all in one school, their entire elementary career well known to the entire staff of that school, supported as a family by that school, removed on a Thursday afternoon, landed in two different school districts. That makes three school districts involved, only a few miles away, and lost every bit of that continuity. No planning, no thought.
What prevents you from leaving the student in the school where they are right now?
At present, there is nothing that prevents that, but it requires action by the districts. There's no statutory prohibition for a child who leaves, say, Reynolds and moves to Gresham to be permitted to attend Gresham, but what it requires is Reynolds and Gresham to enter into an inter-district transfer.
Isn't there a stay-put rule that the child will stay where they are and will settle the paperwork later?
No. The short answer, Chair Flores and Representative Dahlem, is no. The stay-put provision you may be speaking about is a term of art in the special education law, and that is with respect to a level of placement the child is in, for example, a self-contained classroom versus mainstream. And there are some stay-put-like provisions in the McKinney-Vento Homeless Children Education Act. But to the best of my knowledge, and you've got some experts in the room from the Department of Ed and otherwise who are, I think, prepared to testify in this bill, to my knowledge, there is nothing that requires the district from which the child is moved to allow the child to remain in that school until we settle the paperwork. That's what we're trying to achieve here, actually, is to require that and, again, put the gatekeeping function with the juvenile court, somebody who doesn't have a horse in the race, who isn't going to be required to pay for transportation or isn't going to be required to either take or not take a student, but put it in the juvenile court's realm where the juvenile court can gather the information from all the parties and make that determination about best interests for the child.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin George and Randy Harnish, please.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George, and I work as the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services for Children, Adults, and Families. I'm here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 3075, and I've submitted my written testimony, and you will see that at this point in time, the department has taken a neutral position on this bill. We believe that this bill does provide good public policy for children. It allows kids to aid in their child development. It reduces the impact of kids coming into foster care when they have that stability. We just heard from the Juvenile Rights Project. It provides that sense of stability for these kids. And it also, I believe, it improves the education system by minimizing school mobility problems. I think when some of the questions were raised earlier around why do kids move and what are some of the challenges, due to placement and mobility problems clearly continue to be around the shortage of foster homes in all of our neighborhoods around the state. We continue to try to provide neighborhood-based foster care. We need to continue to look for foster homes and folks willing to step forward, but the fact of the matter is it continues to be a capacity versus need issue. So that is a significant problem. We also at times will see children moving from home to home or from school district at times to deal with safety issues. It is not safe for them to stay in their same neighborhood, their same school. There's reasons to move them, as well as being placed with relatives. One of the charges of the department is to look for relatives first and foremost when we have children needing foster care. And approximately 30% of the children we do have in foster care today are with relatives. And so it may be that grandma lives across town in another school district or in the next city down, and we have a value placing children with relatives. And so that will be another reason the children may actually be moving schools. The department at this point in time have identified that there will be a fiscal impact to House Bill 3075. We are uncertain exactly what that cost might be. We are asking at this point in time, as we've had conversations with the bill sponsors, that we look at providing a report to the legislature by January of 2007 by moving forward with this program as is, and as we will then sort out the costs of it over the next 2 years and then report back to this legislature around whether the bill should, or whether the state law should continue to be in that. So that's what we're proposing at this point in time. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have or clarify some other statements that I've made.
Mr. George, what are the costs that you speculate would be incurred for DHS?
At the current point in time, we reimburse foster parents or volunteers 40 cents a mile. That's the federal regulation on reimbursement. We have did a pretty ballpark range, and the ballpark can be anywhere from $200,000 to approximately $700,000 for a school year, given the number of kids we're talking about. We are serving about 7,000 kids in foster care on an average daily basis, and about 67% of those kids are school-aged children.
Was my understanding from the testimony that the that there was going to be some provision by for that transportation cost? So are you're staking that your statement on transportation reimbursement costs?
I'm sorry, Chair Flores, I'm not quite understanding your question.
You indicated you pay 40 cents a mile to the foster family.
Correct.
And so you're anticipating that there are going to be, that's going to be the piece that's going to have the greatest fiscal impact, is your reimbursement for transportation?
Yes, Chair Flores, that certainly is one of the significant pieces. If it is about, that's how we've been able to base it, is we try to identify how many children there are in the foster care system, how many of those children are in a district that's other than where their home district was, where they were removed from, and then try to calculate to say, of these children, if they are going 5 miles, 7 miles, 10 miles, then a cost of that would be 40 cents a mile. So it's a really rough, and that's why we were unable to come up with a very hard number. It's really rough and speculative. It's also based on foster parents being able to do that, of which we know already that some of the foster parents will not be able to do that. So we'll be looking at agency staff or identifying volunteers to do this for these children.
Additional questions for Mr. George? Thank you. Mr. Harnish.
Oh. If I may jump in one moment, just because the door was open, and I always tell the foster parents that I work with that I always advocate for them. One of the questions that frequently comes up is how much are they paid, and I think Representative Farr asked that question. Foster parents are actually reimbursed for $12 to $16 per day. For those that are caring for their high special needs children, they may get a special rate that actually might go up to $25 per day. So we're not talking about anybody having an ability to really make a living off this when you're dealing with one child or two children. So that's really the ballpark issue, and so I thank you for that.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Randy Harnish, and I'm with the Department of Education. And I wanted to take this opportunity to let you know that we are at the department very much in support of the concept of working to provide as much stability as possible for kids in foster care and maintaining that through their educational placement. We did identify a couple of issues, and I've talked to the sponsors about that. One of them you've already heard about, which was the contracted time for submitting and getting records transferred. I think that we would be able to work out some kind of an expedited records process, given the opportunity to talk about amendments. Secondly, folks in our special education office have reviewed this specifically with respect to the recently reauthorized Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the 2004 IDEA. And I believe you heard a bill last week, HB 3168, which would bring into alignment current Oregon statute with the current IDEA requirements. there are possibly some inconsistencies between that IDEA language and the language in House Bill 3075. Our staff did indicate that those were probably fairly minor and could be dealt with rather quickly. So with those minor technical changes, we would be able to work together and come up with a plan to make this transition more smoothly.
Representative Dolan.
Yes. Mr. Harnish, did you look at the money following the student? In special ed, we have a whole different set of rules, but when a district has reached their 11% cap, to take someone that's a non-resident really is an imposition on them financially, and we certainly want to leave that student where we can educationally do the most good, but there is a money issue in special ed. There's also an issue of tuition agreements with a regular ed student. Have you looked at that and the financial impact to the receiving district?
Representative Flores, Representative Dolan, my understanding is that what's proposed in this bill is that when a juvenile court determines that a student needs to or should remain in his or her home district, that student would be considered a resident of that home district, even though their physical residence may have moved across a district boundary. So a kid lives in school district X, is placed by DHS and by the juvenile court in district, X, Y. The student would be considered a resident of District X for purposes of claiming state school funds, even though their physical presence residence was no longer there.
But there is the issue of the local property tax support. And local districts have been very good about inter-district attendance agreements. They've been very good about trading or looking to the best interest of the students, in my experience anyway. But it seems as though we should have a provision that the money would follow the student, because place of residence is important in the funding scheme for Oregon schools. And we now have a student with a residence in one community and attendance in another. And as far as the property tax goes, at least that portion, it would seem that there should be an amendment to allow the money to follow the student.
Chair Flores, Representative Dolan, I would actually have to go back and talk to our school finance gurus on this if at that level of detail, but my understanding is that this bill would in effect treat a student in this situation as if there were an inter-district transfer from the student's residence, the actual resident.
With the money following?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What would be a appropriate time period for getting those records out?
Chair Flores, Representative March, I think one way that we've talked about looking at this is less in terms of the timeline and more in terms of what in that record is absolutely necessary and most critical in making a placement decision. So an expedited process might be to find out and to come up with some kind of a truncated record that could follow the kid or be faxed over as quickly as possible, rather than to look at a time. And again, this is just off the top of my head, an example of what we might do.
In that regard, I just find it difficult that if this is the child we're talking about, we can't go to the shelf, pull the file, and transmit it to somebody within hours, let alone 20 days, 10 days request, 10 days turnaround. And this bill says 3 days and 3 days. So while I like the idea of being able to have some sort of an emergency sheet, or as you said, truncated record, I still find it difficult to perceive why we can't pull a file and get it out of the door.
Well, Chair Flores, if the record was the size of the one that you held up, I think that was a perfectly reasonable thing to expect. In many cases, the record that we're looking at for students, depending on where they are in their educational experience, could be 10 to 20 or 30 times that size, so.
The size notwithstanding my comment.
True.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Beth Capps and Catherine White.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, I'm Beth Cash with Children First for Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Children First is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to advocating for smart investments and policy choices that support the well-being of Oregon's children. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3075. We know that school mobility jeopardizes academic success, and particularly for foster children who have a lack of stability in their lives. Anyways, it's especially important that we create educational continuity for these children. We feel that House Bill 3075 does just that, and so we certainly urge your support of this bill. I've passed out a copy of the section from our most recent county-level data book around foster children and educational continuity, and one of our recommendations was many of the components of this bill. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, which is a disability policy council. I'll make my comments very, very brief. We believe that, in fact, this is very good policy. As you have heard already, that many of the children in foster care experience disabilities. And we want to reiterate the comments that have been made in terms of educational placement. And that holds even more true for the need for educational placement for kids with disabilities, to make sure that there's stability in those placements. You know, we know that successful programming for kids with disabilities, even with very highly skilled teachers, is an art, and it takes time, and it takes high skill, and it takes knowing the child well, knowing what strategies work, what doesn't work, and it sometimes isn't reflected on the piece of paper that gets transferred. So we feel it's very important to maintain that educational placement and that educational stability as much as possible. Just one other comment. In one of my former lives, I was a high school teacher, and I worked a lot with kids who were in special ed. And there's nothing more devastating to both a parent and to a child to have a kid come into your classroom who you know has special needs and for whom you have no information on, and to see them sit in the classroom inappropriately placed, not receiving the services that they desperately need. So I think that this is a bill that is absolutely essential for kids. I think it's good for schools. I think it's good for teachers. So thank you.
Thank you. Do you have questions, Ms. White? Thank you very much. Well, I'm told that we do indeed have a vehicle that might be able to accommodate some of the amendment interests that we're talking about. So I'd like the interest holders to coordinate with Mr. Keller, and we'll see what we need to do to bring this bill to fruition. Thank you. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3075. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2554. Mr. Keller?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2554 transfers a program that provides financial assistance for the child care costs to low-income student families from the Department of Human Services to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, creates a student child care program in the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, transfer monies for the program from the Department of Human Services to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2005, and we do have an amendment, and it also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, are we looking at the Dash 5 amendment?
We are looking at the Dash 5 amendment.
Okay. And Morgan Kelly.
Chair Flores, members of the House Education Committee. My coworker just ran to get Representative Dalto, who wanted to come here today. Would you like me to get started, or?
Why don't you go?
Okay.
Well, see how she can fly.
Again, for the record, my name is Morgan Cowling, and I am the Legislative Director of the Oregon Student Association. The Oregon Student Association, which represents over 100,000 students in the Oregon University System, Lane Community College, and Oregon Health and Science University, supports the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2554. The Oregon Student Association has worked closely with Representative Dalto's office to introduce and pass this legislation for two primary reasons. Just to remind you from the last hearing, the first is that the program has been at the top of the Department of Human Services cut list time and time again. And the second reason is this program aligns better with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission.
Don't let me interrupt you.
Do you want to, should I continue? Okay. During the public hearing on this bill a couple of weeks ago, both the Student Assistance Commission and the Department of Human Services testified in support of this bill, but recommended a couple of changes. The Dash 5 that you have before you is a result of those requests. The first part of the Dash 5 is the delaying implementation of the program move to a year within the biennium, so that it will spend the first year at the Department of Human Services and the second year at the Assistance Commission. We believe that that will ensure a smooth transition and that no harm will come to the students who are receiving assistance. The second part of the Dash 5 amendment is grandfathering students in. During the hearing, it came to our attention that the House Bill 2554 specifically said it would receive assistance if you were a student at a 2- or 4-year nonprofit or private institution. However, as the program is currently administered through the Department of Human Services, there are several, I think handful, maybe 8 students who attend for-profit institutions. So the second part of this amendment would grandfather those students who are currently attending for-profit institutions in, so they would continue to receive assistance. The Department of Human Services has also said that they will change an administrative rule in the first year of the administration of this program, so that no future students, more students who are attending for-profit institutions will come on and receive the program, so that by the time this program actually moves to the Assistance Commission, there will probably be 2 to 4 people who are actually grandfathered under the second part of this amendment. That's all I have today. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let us hear from Representative Dalto. Thank you for blowing in.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the whirlwind has arrived from my other committee. Madam Chair, Billy Dalto, members of the committee, Billy Dalto, State Representative for Oregon's 21st House District. I don't have anything to add. I think Morgan did a nice job bringing you up to speed for where we are. Just want to again lend my support and ask you to move the Dash 5 amendments and get this on the Ways and Means at your first opportunity, because we need to get this in the hopper, move on to the next important bill. So, thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for either Representative Dalto or for Ms. Kelly?
I see a jar there, Madam Chair.
I'm learning to read peripherally those nods. And Representative Solomon.
Madam Chair, I move that the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill.
Oh, wait, we have other testimony. We're not even in a work session yet. So
it's just so exciting to get going.
I'm ready to go.
Thank you, Representative Solomon. You heard the car, the call.
Billy sits next to me on the floor, and when Billy says move, I move.
I hear you.
But not on fluoride, evidently. That's the inside. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, with that, we'll call Julie Shaharney. Oh, she isn't here.
Julie is currently in another hearing, and I believe was going to be here, but...
Shall we talk real slow?
No, I think we. I would say.
I think we're ready to move forward. I think we're good. We will. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2554. We will open a work session on House Bill 2554. Representative Dollar,
I'm ready.
Go.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 2554.
Representative Dollar moves the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2554. Is there discussion? Okay, any objections?
So moved.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2554 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be...
As amended?
As amended, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means as a prior reference.
Representative Dollum moves House Bill 2554 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there a discussion? No. Those of the opinion, House Bill 2554 should be reported to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Lynn?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Miller? Aye.
Vice Chair
Mark.
Aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And let me see. I think there is no further business. I was just pondering whether or not to tell you of my hectic and chaotic schedule at the end of the week, but I think I can do that for you on Wednesday. So the House Education Committee is adjourned, and thank you very much. Thank you.
I won't be here Friday.